tortured in the, inside this investigation center all the time, during the day, during the night, deprivation of sleep, transportation to the court. It has been a process to see how Israel is evolving with impunity. I think they are acting in a way that we could expect next interception to be at the shores of Ibiza, or at the shores of Mallorca, where there is no limit for the crime that they are willing to take, the risks that they are willing to put people in, just to justify a false accusation that they have nothing to prove, and they have, they don't need even to explain why they are doing this, illegally kidnapping all of us. So what we really have to be concerned of, if we have somebody with a double nationality, that we have seen such a huge mobilization politically, and we have seen the media coverage and the social mobilizations everywhere. Imagine how Palestinians are being treated. Imagine the violations that people from Palestine are receiving. I mean, we heard about packs of dogs that are being trained to rape Palestinian men. Yes.
We have 10 seconds.
Just to say that the testimonies that we are receiving from the Palestinian prisoners who are being released is nothing compared to the experience that we have. The continuous rape of women, of men, the continuous violations, the administrative detention. This is a government that is acting this way for so long.
We have to leave it there. Saif Abukeshek, Spanish and Swedish national of Palestinian origin, speaking to us from Turkey. That does it for our show. We'll be in Austin and Houston this weekend.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. Today is Tuesday, May 12th, a beautiful day and an important day. We're moving towards the recognition, the celebration, the observance of the George Floyd incident in South Minneapolis. And we'll tell you more as we go along today, but we're planning to be broadcasting, thanks to KFAI, every day next week, Monday through Friday, live from George Floyd Square, in observance of the solemnity and the consequentiality of that horrific event, but also in celebration of the community's response and raising the question of what it looks like 6 years out and where do we go from here. Well, today I'm pleased to have one of our columnists be the featured guest today, and then one of my regular colleagues here joining me in conversation. Here is Haley Taylor Schlitz, Esquire. She's an attorney, an amazing, phenomenal Black woman attorney, a young person who writes a column for Insight News and other national publications as well. She'll tell you about that. She's getting a lot of attention, a lot of traction nationally for her wisdom, for her incisiveness, for her clarity, and for the fierceness with which she attacks the opportunity and the challenges that beset our community, with the opportunities that emerge from that spirit of resilience and the quest for liberation, for freedom out of our community. Well, co-piloting today is my colleague and friend, a fellow Morehouse man, Jonathan Palmer. Brother Jonathan, how you doing, man? Good to see you again. You're muted, Jonathan.
Good to see you as well, Alan. Excited to be on here with Haley. It's good to see you again as well.
Very excited.
And Carla Smith is listening. Carla, thank you for listening. And for those who are checking us out, either on the radio here at KFAI or on Facebook or LinkedIn, or other channels, YouTube. Let us know where you are, who you are, and join the conversation just by dropping your post, your questions, your comments, your disagreement into the chat. We'll share them. This is about us connecting and us communicating. That's what we have to do. We have to be with each other with intention. And really, that's really what this is all about today. So Haley has an article that is entitled, Who Will Answer the Call? It's a, and she's proposing, she's saying that a grand summit for Black America cannot wait. And in that column, she's arguing that Black America needs more than scattered responses to each new attack on our rights, on our history, on our institutions, and on our future. She says we need a national grand summit of Black leaders across generations, regions, organizations, faith communities, education, law, media, labor, business, and grassroots movements to respond to this moment, its strategy and collective purpose. Well, Haley, I'm so glad that you have brought this question forward. I think you're the right person, and this is the right time. And as we were preparing for this show, Haley and Jonathan, I was thinking that, you know, I'm excited that you are stepping forward as a young Black woman out of your generation, but clearly a leader and prepared to lead and serve our community and humanity. You have the conviction, the knowledge, the genius, and the capability to bring, I think, a lot to the world. And so I'm pleased with that. I'm also pleased, though, that you represent, in some of your columns, you describe yourself as a Gen Z Black woman. My point in bringing that up is that I think, Jonathan, that the next iteration of our movement will be movement led by Black women. That's what I think. But, you know, I'd be interested in our listeners, in our viewers, weighing in on how you see and what you see as the role of leadership in our community. And in particular, do you agree or disagree that the leadership going forward will be the leadership of Black women? Well, Haley, I'm putting a lot on your plate.
No, I appreciate it. You know, Jonathan, I'll jump in just right here because I appreciate all that Al said. You know, the column that he's referring to, for those of you listening in, I actually wrote in 2025. I actually wrote it a year ago. It was on Insight News. So check it out, of course, as we talk or after this. And it was in response to Roe v. Wade being overturned. And I really, really find it fascinating and kind of startling as well how relevant it is again today, how relevant it's been since 2016, throughout the course of the year since I wrote it. But obviously, again, today, with what the Supreme Court recently decided in regards to the Voting Rights Act, I have a little excerpt that I pulled from the column that I think will be like a really good kind of kickoff for this. Sure. As Jonathan jumps in too. Again, for those viewers, the column was titled "Who Will Answer the Call? A Grand Summit for Black America Cannot Wait." And that column starts with the first sentences: "Our history does not always announce its turning points. Often it arrives in silence or chaos, with only those paying close attention recognizing that something foundational is shifting. Today, the signs are impossible to ignore." And then the column ends with, "This is not the time to wait for others to act. This is the time to build what we need. Let the call go out. Let the gathering begin. Let history remember that in a moment of crisis, Black America met the moment with courage, clarity, and collective power." And so, again, you know, this was in response to Roe v. Wade being overturned. But like I just said, with the Supreme Court's recent decision regarding the Voting Rights Act, it is very relevant, particularly, again, and almost exactly a year later. So I know we'll get into the conversation and what I mean and what I'm thinking. I'll let Jonathan jump in. But that's the column. So as we talk, for those of you who are watching, you know, go open a new tab and hop over so you can see what we're referring to.
Jonathan, jump in. How you doing, my friend, again?
I am doing pretty good. And so excited for this conversation. Excited because I'm heading out tomorrow for 35th college reunion at Morehouse. So these topics will be a lot of our discussion. My class of 91 started the Zoom meeting during the pandemic, you know, to keep people connected, and it would just be on all the time. And since then, we've kept it up. I'm one of the hosts of that every Friday night. So we get on and we talk about these topics. We talk about things that we want to see happen. We have people connected from the Senator Raphael Warnock in our class to Judge Rupert Birdsong out in California. And so there's always good conversation around these topics, and this is really poignant. So excited to be here. Excited to talk about Haley's article, which is really well written. Great job with that.
Thank you. So,
What do you feel has changed, Haley, since a year ago?
You know, and I think that is a really good question, because it's kind of two sides of the same coin. A lot has changed, but also nothing has changed. And what the Supreme Court did, what they decided in relation to the Voting Rights Act, it was a case out of Louisiana, but it impacts the entire nation. And I say that, and that may be obvious. Well, yeah, you know, as Supreme Court decisions do, they impact the entire nation. But no, genuinely, this decision is targeting Black Americans, our voices, our votes, and our power all over the country. This came out of Louisiana, but again, as Supreme Court decisions do, it's something that shapes and impacts and regulates and controls every single district, every single state, every single line that is drawn. And so in moments like this, I think it's really important for our response to these actions to be to come together. And so to answer your question, Jonathan, I think a lot has changed. I think a lot changes every day. We get new facts, new information. But the call is the same. And the people, the organizations, the leaders, the communities that need to answer it and how we're going to answer needs to be the same as well. These communities, Black communities across the country, need to come together in response to this call. Piecemealing it and individual responses in different communities in different states is not going to work in such an important moment like this.
Have we done this before? Jonathan, you and I go back a long ways, and we've been at national summits, regional summits, state summits. So the question has been raised. What in your memory have been the responses over time?
Well, I think generally there is this sentiment of we need to bring together some collective action, and things need to be addressed. I think where things kind of splinter a bit, and I think this gets to Haley's point, is that we end up doing this a lot in silos. And so, you know, it's one group that has the summit, and they're going to go ahead and come out with some action items, but then they're not connected to the next group. The Black MBAs are not connected to the Black Attorneys Association. And so what you end up with is a little bit of action coming out, but then it kind of peters out, because it's not the network that Haley is talking about. And what we really need, I think, right now is collective action across the board and a unified agenda. I mean, when you look at the civil rights movement, it was not everybody in the country all on the same page. But when we look back in history, we talk about the main movements and people like Martin Luther King, Dr. King and Andrew Young and so many others that were around the center part of that. But there were other movements and pieces, and you had to bring together SNCC and others like that. I think we need that same kind of approach. And what's happened is over time, as people have gotten rights, as people have gotten a little piece of freedom, people have become a little bit relaxed about it. And the sense of urgency, fierce urgency of now, has not been there.
Right.
But I think people are starting to get that. And Haley, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the fact that what this means in terms of voting rights, how that really affects everybody on a day-to-day piece.
Right. And I think that's a really, really good bridge, because where I was, how I was going to build off of this, and it's a voting piece, but it's also a big picture. And I think that's what you were alluding to, Jonathan. So like I said, to build off of it, like you said, we're working individually right now. There's a lot of examples of organizations doing great work across the country, you know, online meetings, events, protests, and voting summers, and all of that is really great, and it's necessary. It's not work that's mutually exclusive. It's not something that has to stop, but that isn't enough. And like I was saying earlier, it really can't be piecemeal. This has to be planned, has to be orchestrated in every state. Clear goals and assignments need to be divvied, discussed, and assigned, and there must be a way to measure success and goals that need to be met. There really has to be accountability in this too from our community and from our leaders. So when, Jonathan, your question about this impacting voting, you know, the Supreme Court's decision is going to impact voting in a way where, you know, racism and gerrymandering can put on a mask of partisanship and drawing maps in a way that it's based on, you know, Democrat, Republican, or different policy ideas, but really it is discrimination against racial groups, specifically Black Americans. And that's why this call is so urgent, like you said, the urgency of now, but also big picture. And what I was referring to with this Grand Summit, it's going to address the voting rights issue, but I wrote this a year ago. So it's also going to address Roe v. Wade being overturned. It's also going to address how we're going to handle the next couple of years of this administration and what the plan is to make sure we don't have a repeat of any version of this administration in the next presidential cycle. So it really is big picture, and accountability, I think, is going to be key here, because my Grand Summit is not just a theoretical, let's all come together and do one big event, one big like media press conference. It really is intentionally structured accountability. And Black families, Black Americans are really looking for that plug-in, but also that accountability so we can measure success and progress, because I think it's really important for us to keep in mind that a lot of individuals that we're seeing right now are very ego-driven, and we need to be community-driven right now. We need to combine forces, like you said, Jonathan, Black lawyers, Black doctors, NABJ, NAACP, the Congressional Black Caucus, Jack and Jill and other social groups, sororities and fraternities, cross-generational, and churches, small businesses. It really is a national movement coming together. And again, not just a press conference, but that second piece to this national summit is coming together as one, rather than piecemealing across the country individually in our states and in our districts. But on top of that, having that divide and conquer, that plan and accountability. It's plan and accountability. So that way we can, when we check in, when it's the next presidential cycle, when history looks at the eyes of today, looks through the eyes of today and sees the what how our response was, it we have that accountability to follow up when we have those measurement tools for success.
How do you see this unfolding, Haley? Do you see us moving towards this grand summit this year before the midterms, or setting the plan in place or the discussion in place? How's it going to unfold?
I think that is really the mobilization question, the practical, how to make this idea we're discussing, how do we see this becoming a reality? I think that platforms like Insight News, the conversation with Al McFarland, is really great, because Black media needs to highlight and lift these ideas, and also needs to highlight and lift when the Grand Summit happens, and also the plan and the accountability thereafter. So I think that this first step already shows that these conversations are happening and rolling, and whoever's listening will bring that to their communities and so forth and so on. So I've had this conversation on a couple different Black media platforms already, such as Roland Martin's platform. And so I think these conversations need to keep going. And hopefully by the time, you know, major elections are running around again, we have had this summit or is very in near in the future. So that way we do have this foundation, this plan and accountability, both of those points, especially as we roll into the next presidential cycle.
So describe what do you see in your mind's eye for the actual, both the event, if it's an event, and the process. I think it's more, it's both, it's not, it not is. One or the other.
It really is. It really yeah. is. You know, and that is something that, you know, it's easy to call, but having the people come into the space to do the work is going to be the difference between success and it actually occurring and not. And so, yeah, when I say someone needs to call the intentional, like, national summit, what I was picturing in my head, again, it doesn't have to be this group, because ideally it's all of us coming together anyway, but I was picturing the Congressional Black Caucus, someone who really does have this national weight and national sway, and has people from different walks of life and diversity across the country in a localized location already, can call the rest of us to meet together at the table. That's what I was picturing in my head. And then at this national grand summit, we can have an intentional response, an intentional crisis emergency response to what we're seeing, what we've seen since last year, what we're seeing again, what we will continue to see until we respond, or it'll continue to go downhill. And so really, I think that this summit hopefully will be called by a group like the Congressional Black Caucus and various organizations across the country respond. We plan a date, a time, a location, a hybrid style, and come together to really plan what is it that different organizations can do? What are we seeing in our local communities? And what is the call that needs to be answered? And then obviously divvy up who will be answering that call, which goes back to the core question of my column. And I think that really what are we waiting for is kind of what I would want to prompt for anyone who's listening or as this idea circulates. Are we waiting for slavery to be on the ballot, on a ballot that our voices don't count for because we've already been gerrymandered out of existence? Where are we going to draw the line? What will be enough to prompt this discussion? What matters enough? Whose rights? Where's the line? And so really, I think that's how I pictured it in my head. That's who would call it. That's what the purpose would be. It may span a day or two of work, but obviously the true ripples are going to be continuing for months after. And then perhaps another grand summit a year later or 6 months later or something along those lines to have that accountability piece and follow up and say, this is what worked. This is what didn't. This is what we're going to change as more elections come around. I think you're muted.
So would it be like a DNC convention or a political convention? What would it be like? I'm trying to get a sense of how this would work. And you also mentioned technology. You mentioned hybrid.
Right.
Just, tease it out some more. How do you figure out how to get people together, especially with the challenges of travel, challenges of cost of travel right now? But I think you raised the question, where do you draw the line? Do you wait till slavery's on the ballot and then you say we got to meet? Or what do you do right now? Use both the idea of a physical engagement and the technology together to have the greatest amount of impact and engagement? What do you think?
Exactly. And I think that great minds will be able to come together to formulate an actual agenda or actual breakout sessions. But what I'm imagining in my head is something like the conferences that we're seeing from the Democratic Party or from the NAACP. We obviously Black Americans, Black communities and Black organizations have hosted, annual conferences, boules and regionals all the time from all different perspectives and organizations and community groups. So something similar to that, but on a grand scale. And like you said, the cost of travel and being in Minnesota, we're well aware that there are many people who would fear leaving the front door, much less going through TSA, flying to wherever this conference is going to be held and trying to get their voice heard and be engaged and figure out how they can plug into the work that's happening. So yes, it would need to be hybrid. Fortunately, one of the few things that COVID did positively impact on our nation, at least, was the development of this telecommunication, this FaceTime, this way of meeting that doesn't have to be in the same exact room. And that can allow people who otherwise can't afford to travel, can't take the time off of work, to just doesn't have the means for whatever reason, can still show up, can still be heard, and can still listen to the plans that are brewing and figure out ways that they can plug in individually or in their communities as well. Spread the word for the work that's being done, and also help us hold each other accountable at the next summit. They also heard what was discussed, what the plan was, and can bring that back to the next conversation. So something just like you're referring to, Al, but again, on a very national level, something I think it's really important that we're not piecemealing this, that all these organizations who are doing great work individually come together and take some of that effort and that energy and manpower and bring that to the table, a national table. And from there, again, it can be hybrid. It can have different email plugins, things where even if you can't attend the conference, you can still hear what happened, still hear what was agreed upon, still find ways to plug in from there.
Shamath Pereira, I think. Let me shout you out. Thank you for the like and others who are joining the conversation. I see Melvin Whitfield Carter Jr. Dropped a note in the chat. Compliments to you, Haley. He says she's heaven sent. So I agree. And here's a comment from a regular contributor, Big Cheese S3E. Al McFarland, I believe this may be the beginning of the end of the CDC because of their prioritizing illegal immigrants over the Black community and their benign neglect agenda towards FBA, Foundational Black Americans. What do you think? Explain what FBA is and explain the thinking. Big Cheese, I'm going to ask you to go deeper. I see you've got some more, but let's have that conversation. Haley, you first, and then Jonathan, jump in.
And Jonathan, I am interested in hearing what you have to say, but I'll just provide my first initial thoughts. the big cheese. I do understand that perspective. You know, I think that it's really important that the Congressional Black Caucus establish that they're hearing our call and that their priorities lie with a national movement. I do think that that's the call right now for them. I think that is the plug-in. Like I said, that was what I, in my mind's eye, who would even call the summit to begin with, and where the planning, where the kind of the brain of the operation would be. So I can see that perspective of, you know, what will the CBC do, and you know, how will that trajectory impact their presence in the Black community across this country going forward.
Well, no, I will say that I can understand the frustration of feeling that the CBC is prioritizing illegal immigrants over the Black community. I think we want to be careful, though, of going ahead and pitting one group against the other.
Right.
The idea that there needs to be a priority of the CBC on the Black community is one that should be a no-brainer. That is definitely true, but we don't want to go ahead and minimize the struggles that are happening, because that's exactly what those within the power structure want to do. They go ahead and they pit us against one another. They go ahead and say, this is a priority over here, and this person is going to take from you. We've got to figure out a way to advance all of our agendas at the same time and bring into focus the one that may need the most help in the moment. I wonder if that this isn't a two-level kind of structure. We're talking about our next steps and what needs to happen. One thing I will give to conservatives is they are consistent when they get their two or three bullet points, and that's all they say. And they talk about how it's safe now. It's not bad to be a white person anymore. And that, you know, we need to go ahead and get rid of abortion rights and things like that. So they stick
Jonathan,
to their.
Let me jump in, because, you know, Big Cheese also put another post in. And what you said about the Republicans, conservatives, mm-hmm. is that they always have their top two or three points. Unfortunately, right. in our community, we always hear this points that we make saying that we have done absolutely nothing for the Black community for 40 years. I think that's a disservice. I think it's not true. And I think that to the degree that we find ourselves always parroting this negative description of who we are and what we have done and can do, we continue to deserve and we enable those who want to continue the marginalization of our people. What do you think? And Big Cheese, you may disagree. Please drop your next post in, letting you know that I totally and completely disagree with you.
I will say that, Al, I agree with you. I think that I think part of the issue becomes that there is so much happening. We are being assaulted on every front, so it is hard to sometimes see what progress is being made, or the progress a lot of times is behind the scenes. It is.
You're
2 a.m. and you're having those. We don't see all of the things that are happening. And I agree with you that it is a disservice when we go and we pit against each other and we fight. If you don't feel one group is being as effective, work to help make them more effective. Contribute to that. You know, the difference, I think, with those of us who tend to be towards the left, whether you're left or you're liberal or wherever it is we look for just what Haley is talking about, accountability. And that can sometimes be a problem. The right doesn't care about accountability. I mean, it's really easy to advance when you don't care about facts and you don't care about actually holding yourself to standards. The thing that allows them to move so far ahead and be so popular is the fact they're not concerned about these things. They don't sit around and hold each other accountable. When something comes up and it says, oh, this was not true, we haven't gone ahead and gotten rid of all of the nuclear capabilities in Iran. We haven't gone ahead and eliminated, you know, the tax breaks that people need. when you look at the fact that we're talking about, they were celebrating most recently legislation around people in schools being able to pick fruit now, peel fruit and give that out. Well, that doesn't really help when you cut the money going to schools to provide food and for the resources. So I think that there's a piece here where we have to take an asset-based approach and look at what are the good things that we have rather than focusing on the negative. What are the positive things? What are the structures we can work with? How do you make it work versus simply going ahead and saying this doesn't work for us?
Melvin Carter asked, who is Big Cheese? Big Cheese, identify yourself. Let us know who you are and from where you're coming from. You've added two more comments here. And for our radio audience, let me share what you have said. You say, unfortunately, Democratic shills are out of touch with the FBA, the Foundation of Black American Family. You say that we have a delineation movement that has grown a critical mass and that's growing across the United States. And you also add, I believe, that, let's see, the FBA family is not concerned with coalitions with non-FBA groups. We're only looking out for ourselves. Well, I guess what I can say about that is that that's a position that you're welcome to have. You know, somebody has to do it and somebody has to say it, and it may as well be you. Because every position on the spectrum has to be occupied. And you simply staked out where you stand. And my hope and desire is that in the belief of how you are assembling the world, you work and you build and you try to create freedom for our people. And you do that in a way that's massive and effective. And I believe that the pathway is simply by building, but not by destroying. You may feel, however, that the pathway is to knock everybody else off the hill, and therefore you end up being the last voice standing, which is not a victory in my point of view. It's a surrender, and it's a defeat, and it's an acceptance of a pathology, a process of divide and conquer that has damaged us up through now. Jonathan, what do you think?
I agree. Again, an asset-based approach. If you think there's a problem, find a solution to it. If you think a group isn't working towards that, go ahead and either help that group to achieve or develop your own solutions and come with it. We spend a lot of time tearing each other down. We spend a lot of time infighting and going towards that. We have struggles in common with people across the BIPOC community, with the quote-unquote illegal immigrants. We have people who are just looking for the same rights that we are. Mm-hmm. And what is unifying us is they're being assaulted by the right. Yep. They are coming after all of our rights, all of the things that we need to do, and they are systematically disenfranchising us. And so if you don't feel like the Congressional Black Caucus or the NAACP or any of them are doing what they need to do, either get involved with them and help them do that, or go ahead and form your own platform. But it doesn't have to be pitting one against the other. It can be working in conjunction. That's what happened with the Civil Rights Movement. SNCC and Dr. King and all of them didn't always agree. They came together, though, and focused on different aspects of the movement so that they could find
Go ahead, Haley.
I was gonna say, can I jump in too? Because honestly, I want to echo what Jonathan is saying. He's back. Sorry, Jonathan. But no, I want to echo what Jonathan is saying. I think it's really important that we keep in mind that we cannot be divided right now. And I think that's kind of the consensus between our three perspectives on this, the Big Cheese. But I also do want to reframe this, because I feel like this is a little bit of like a distraction, the Big Cheese, from what I originally framed this as. I think that accountability, as Jonathan was kind of leaving off before I jumped in, is where this all lies. I think it's important for us to keep ourselves accountable too. We really had to be united in this. And something I wanted to bring to the table out on that point is what I think should, will, be coming is this great migration. We've seen it before a lot in history, you know, when slavery was abolished and, you know, many other points where specifically, especially Black Americans have moved, you know, to the West, back to the South, to the North. We've seen that, of course, over the course of time. And I think that we will see another one. I think we need to, as Black Americans, talk about where we live, because we need to move out of the states that don't value us. And that's the South, right? Like, we'd call it what it is. The South really does not value us as Black Americans, doesn't value the contributions that we're bringing to that state. They really take our power for themselves, take it from us and use it for themselves. And, you know, I have an example here, a little statistic, if you will, how Texas, which is where I'm from, so that's why I bring it up. The Black population, you know, we've moved heavily to Texas over the past decade. About 1.4 million people have moved, Black people in Texas. So it begs the question, you know, they gained congressional seats from that. They've gained economic power from that. They gained electoral votes from that. But for who? Who, as we bring our power to that state, how are we seeing that power be used and reflected of the constituents, of the people who reside in that state? And so I think that that's kind of the second point I wanted to bring to this conversation today, is kind of that great migration. I think it's really important that, you know, the Grand Summit is fantastic, but a long-term impact and a deeper impact is going to be this great migration that I think is inevitable either way, but I'm hoping is going to be in response to what we're seeing now. We need to leave these states that don't value us. Like I said, the South, Alabama, Texas, Louisiana, we need to leave these states that don't value us as people, that don't value our voices, that don't respect what we are contributing to the state. And if we leave, they will feel that impact and it will shape their policy from there. And also, if we migrate to states that value us, it's better.
Leave to where? Maybe you said it, but leave to where? What would you think?
You jumped right in exactly where I was going. I think that we need to go to states that, well, do value us. And a lot of those states are in the North, or what are deemed blue states. And it's not every blue state. We need to go to blue states that have the infrastructure to support Black Americans when we move there, that support and value us. So say, for example, here in Minnesota, we see Governor Walz sign the Minnesota Voting Rights Act into law in 2024. Okay, so this Supreme Court recent decision was in 2026, but this was something that's not reactive. It's not in response to. It was the values were demonstrated early on, an onset, early demonstration. And these, you know, we've seen 9 states total, I'll say that have passed into law a Voting Rights Act of their own. And we need every blue state to do something like that, but not everyone has. So as we consider this great migration, as we move to states that value us, because we're not going to be able to live in these states, even if you, you know, are in denial that maybe the state will value you, does value you, or, you know, you can force it to value you, it doesn't. So as we see these, you know, decisions develop, and as the Supreme Court gives these states more power to be discriminatory, and they do, we need to move to these states that, number one, value us, but number two, have the infrastructure to capitalize on that value, allow us to act on that and utilize our power for ourselves as well as for the state as a whole.
I'm going to push back on that in a little bit, Haley, and my pushback will come from lived experience. And lived experience makes me question whether a state like Minnesota is one where Black people are valued, because the data suggests that the disparities in quality of life, economic and housing and wealth are horrific. And that despite the posture, we call it Minnesota nice, those of us who've been here for a long time, that there is a chilling and consistent and pervasive devaluation of Black life and of genuine opportunity. That's what I will say. But from my point of view as a reporter, I see the pattern of disenfranchisement and of rebuffing, resisting, and thwarting genuine, organic economic development for the community. So, having said that, two things are true. The most important thing is that despite that, we have to be the masters of our own destiny, mm-hmm. of our own determination to build the table that serves our people and serves the community. And that despite what the hostility of any environment will produce. At the end of the day, we can't count on anybody saving us. It's us saving ourselves. That's exactly what you're saying, that part of the saving may be the willingness to really relocate, to move and to shift the power dynamics that's based on numbers. I'm going to come back to you, Haley, now, though, and I'm so glad to have this conversation with you. You're, what, 23, 24?
Yes, 23. 23.
Amazing. Amazing. And I'm glad to be in this conversation with you because... and this is a great conversation. I'm approaching 80. Jonathan probably is 45, 50. He's a young guy.
Thank you. Wow, I'm 56. But
I'm just suggesting that we represent three generations, though. And Jonathan and I have said this before, I think to you, Haley, that we are looking at you and we're counting on you. Yes. And that we think that our mission and our job has been to be the best discussants, the best organizers, the best thinkers we can be, and also to be the blockers and the relay race runners that have a commitment and know that our job is to pass the baton, and that we have to understand that you've got a mission of ascent, of ascendance, and that that mission is transformative for all of us, but for the world itself, that we now will approach what existence itself means differently and with a sense of sovereignty that lets us connect. And that's why I believe, I see Big Cheese is saying he's getting bad vibes, but we'll come back to that in a minute. that's why this is important. So in your Gen Z generation, how would you describe the imperative, the mission, the commission, the instruction that is guiding your passion?
Right. And I think that is, I mean, it's not just crucial. It really is the entire picture. You know, of course, we span three different generations, and there are some in between us and some after us, and obviously many more to come after. And I think really, like, the Grand Summit, you know, the foundation of this whole conversation, but also before and after that, how important intergenerational connectedness, communication, teaching really is. You know, you guys being here and talking to me, sharing like, oh, I'm going to push back on this, or I think this is a good idea, or, you know, we disagree on these points with the Big Cheese, or these kinds of conversations are the things that you are handing me your pearls of wisdom. So even if not Minnesota, we can shape this conversation to be, we'll still leave the states, like you said, Al, that don't value you. Take the reins, hold yourself accountable, along with holding others accountable, to shift the power dynamic in this country. Take your congressional seats and go somewhere else. And so whether somewhere else is Minnesota or not, those are the kinds of things that intergenerational, like you said, lived experience is what is being handed down in this conversation. And also what's being handed down, in the broader, bigger conversation as well. So for Gen Z, I mean, I think that this, like, these kinds of discussions, these platforms, and, an event like the Grand Summit are things that we don't have muscle memory. Gen Z, Gen Alpha, we don't have muscle memory. This is it, part of handing, passing the baton, as a term of phrase goes. It's a skill. It's an art. In the middle of a stride, you make sure to hand it and not drop the ball. So those kinds of things, I think these kinds of things, these conversations are really important because, you're able to shape the way I think. So when I say, oh, yeah, a great migration needs to come, you're able to say, even if that's not Minnesota, make sure that you do your research and hold yourself accountable to take your power where it belongs, where it's valued. And these are that's the way the conversation shifts, where I learn and you too can say, hey, this is how I can shape the future, even long after any of us are here. So for Gen Z, Gen Alpha, who doesn't have muscle memory, who doesn't have the lived experience that comes with age, that comes with wisdom, we need it. I mean, it really is. History's it's inevitable to repeat itself if we're trying to start from scratch. Start from square zero, we're going to have to start from square zero at that point and redo everything if we don't have this intergenerational. And I think that'll be really important at the Grand Summit, but also, again, after, long after all of this season is past.
I want to also say, I don't think we want to just...
And your voice is a little low, Jonathan, if you can...
Okay.
There you go. Much better.
Okay. I think we want to not completely abandon the South, and that may not have been where you were going with this, but I think that there are places we can have strongholds. I think that places, especially those with HBCUs, have the ability. I think Georgia is going to be a very strong contender to change in the governor's race. They got a primary coming up. I think it's in about a week. And there's a number of good candidates in there. You've seen a lot of movement across the state with some of the, even though it ultimately didn't win, there was a Black liberal who almost took in the Marjorie Taylor Greene's district. So I think there's a lot of people across the South who are tired of the gerrymandering, right, who are tired of the racist policies. Right. There's some that we shouldn't pour energy into, like you said. But I think there's also some strongholds that we can focus in on and utilize the people we have in those positions.
Right.
Like, you know, my classmate Raphael Warnock, he's right, making some strides over there in Georgia as well.
Right. And if I could just jump in real quick, Jonathan, because it's almost like you can see my notes, because that's actually what I was planning on maybe trying to drop in before we close this conversation for this episode, is that, you know, like kind of where I tried to frame it at the beginning, and that a migration is a long-term game. And also, obviously, there is value in the South and value in recognizing that not everyone can obviously just up and move. But I think it's important also to recognize, and Jonathan, where you, like I said, where you kind of set it up for me as a springboard to use our economic power where we have it right now. You know, we have a lot of economic power in the South. And so when you brought up Georgia or even Alabama was going to be the example I was going to use, for example, our pro athletes. Our athletes at the universities, our athletes at the professional level, there's a lot of power there. There's a lot of power in, you know, us bringing our skills and our, you know, our life craft to those teams. And they're, you know, they get upset when you kneel during a game. I mean, the power that you hold when you unite as players, as our Black boys, especially in these spaces, being the dominant ones in these spaces where a lot of our economic power lies, they will feel the pain of losing what we bring to those universities. If Alabama's losing 82-0, they will feel that pain. You know, if Georgia's losing 72-12, they will feel that pain. And again, that's not to say it's as easy as up and leaving, and that's not to say that the long-term goal is to have a completely divided nation where the South is, you know, a horrible place and to live for Black Americans and, you know, the North is otherwise or something along those lines. But recognizing that we do have more power than what it may feel like in certain moments. We do have a lot of one person won't be enough, right? It's really scary to be the one person where you got an amazing offer from the University of Alabama and you are going to decline it to make your point. They're not going to feel that. Obviously, it's a collective movement. And that's really what I've been trying to string through this whole entire conversation, is how important this national movement, not a piecemeal, is.
Yeah. And so the idea of migration, though, is, again, not new. We've experienced the great migrations in the past. And, you know, in our lifetime, Jonathan, we've heard the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I think, and Malcolm X and the members of the Nation of Islam talk about this idea of a number of states in the Southeast in particular that we migrate to. So that's an iteration of the idea. The movement can be this way or it can be that way. I think, Jonathan, you're saying it's not either or. Perhaps it's both. And it's a question of identifying where and how we can amalgamate power. And the power is by the intentional accumulation of numbers that can impact and change the dynamic. But the problem is, as Louisiana is showing, that the established supremacist structure is willful in denying our effective use of the ballot. And Haley, that's the point you're making, I think, is when they fully reveal themselves as not genuinely committed to the principle of one person, one vote, of democratic inclusion, when they have, in a bold-faced way, continue to reflect that it's only about their power,
right,
and excluding us from it, then we've got some hard things to look at. Jonathan, what are you going to say? You're going to jump in?
this is
you're breaking up.
Point that it ties into that. So it has with what wasn't done. Can you hear me better now?
A little better.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
All right. So much of today's problems stem from the fact that compromising the rights of African Americans in order to preserve the Union was more important than holding racist people accountable in the South and their treason and crimes against humanity. We are reaping the harvest that was planted in the ground those many years ago of not fully addressing the problem of the Confederacy, the problem of systemic racism within our culture, and having people actually recognize just how deeply woven it is into the fabric of American society. We have so much that has been done to advance our culture and our people that when we talk about things like the Voting Rights Act and people are like, well, why do you need this done? When you have a group of white people deciding that the Voting Rights Act is no longer needed, that's a problem right there.
Right.
That should go ahead and be a red flag for everybody. Right. And it's on all the conservative talk networks. The issue is they have never felt the pain and the pressure and the issues that we face. So they cannot conceivably talk about what has been addressed and what needs to happen. Right. They look at the Voting Rights Act and say, we don't need this today because everybody's got the right to vote. And meanwhile, you have people going around and circling in communities and unmarked pickup trucks, going ahead and causing turmoil within that. They're talking about having ICE out at polling stations and things like that. So when you have those same intimidation tactics in the same sentence as we don't need the Voting Rights Act, there's a clear disconnect with the individuals in understanding the impact that that has and why it is necessary to protect people's rights today.
And if I can just build off of that, you know, and I think, Jonathan, that is, you know, this is the balance. This really is the balance, you know, between migrating to states that do value us and have the infrastructure to support and respect our voices and the economic power that we bring, the political power that we bring, you know, the state being there to welcome and support that new population, those migrants. But on top of that, making sure that we do not abandon the South entirely and have that balance of holding them accountable and making sure that we show, you know, we're holding ourselves accountable, but also, of course, stepping up and holding our elected officials accountable and turning out to vote, of course, in every election is the common theme amongst many of these conversations are. And, you know, and I think that, you know, part of that balance is, you know, making sure that we tell our boys, tell our players, you know, like you're going to win them a championship while they take your humanity at the same time. You're going, you know, pro athletes, you know, play for Memphis. You're asking yourself, why? What's worth it? Where do I draw the line? Because if slavery's on the ballot, you're not going to be able to play for Memphis. The last thing on your concern list is going to be, you know, the trade that you've committed yourself, you're committed your life to. So really, you know, like, and again, as these things shift, again, our power and our economic power will follow. So if every player up and left, the economic power, you know, Alabama is not a good team because its color is red. It is a good team because of the players. So if all the players left, of course, the money, the contracts would follow that. But at the same time, the balance is not entirely abandoning the South, not only because that's not feasible as one nation, but on top of that, not everyone can or wants to just up and move away from home and come to a foreign state. So walking that balance, Jonathan, I just wanted to jump in and echo, I think is really important. And moving to states that have the infrastructure, Minnesota or not, is something that we also need to consider in the long run. So having that balance, Jonathan, I just wanted to echo, I think is really important. I think that's a good point.
Well, Melvin Whitfield Carter Jr. added that many of us still own land in the South. So that's another consideration.
Exactly.
And it's back to, you know, working with where we are place-wise, but I think you also are exactly correct, Haley, to be fearless in our capacity to move and to move with intention and to be strategic, both in the geographies, but also the professions, the skills, the education, the systems, the processes that we use. My pushback to you, again, and it's a gentle pushback, is that I don't know that it serves us to expect beneficence from anyone that rather it's a question of what we determine internally. Right. And I call this governance, who we are to each other, versus the social structure, right, what the governor or the climate looks like. Because again, my experience and what we've written about in Inside News is the imbalance, right, and the discernible differentiation of how the overall society reacts when it sees itself, meaning like the Iron Range, in a period of crisis. The state is able to deploy massive resources to bring that community of white people to health. But it has not been the same for the African American or the Black community. And the question is, does that mean we shouldn't try? No. We have to keep pushing to make things happen. Jonathan, jump in. Jonathan, can you hear me?
I wholeheartedly agree. That's the challenge that we've had to fight tooth and nail for everything that we have gotten. And it is not some place that we can rest on our laurels with. It's not some place that we can stop. We have to continue moving ahead. And I think, Haley, you made a great point about the power that exists within the Black community. And I think we are not fully aware of that. I think that's part of the issue, that if we want to push for things like equal rights, for reparations, for all of the addressing the disparities in the wealth gap, all of that is things that we have to make people in power, especially conservative white people, who do not have a context for this. They were not taught this growing up. They were taught a racist agenda, and they were taught a very closed off school agenda that had this idea that we were all equal. And, you know, Black history began with slavery. Sometime later, Martin Luther King was born, Barack Obama became president, and everything is fine now, and we should just move ahead. There is a lot that exists that people do not pay attention to, or they gloss over because it's more convenient than to actually look at the inner self of the America and right, to look at that and say, you know, there's some things wrong here. There's some pieces where the country needs to go into like rehab or do some things in order to change itself if we're going to talk about fulfilling the American dream. Dr. King talked about cashing that check that has come back as marked as insufficient funds. But we know there's money in the bank. If you can build a $400 million ballroom, you have money to go ahead and fund programs that help people within the community. If you can go ahead and spend $1 billion going overseas, you have money to invest in reparations for the community that have been harmed, and we've done it for other communities. We need to look at some of those foundational pieces and actually an acknowledgement that slavery was wrong across the board. Never happened.
We're winding down. I wanted to give Haley the last few minutes to summarize the call and to tell people how they can sort of keep this conversation going. How do you see this unfolding?
Right. No, and I appreciate that, Al, because really, Jonathan, it's what you were saying. We really do have the power, and it's in where we live. It's in the education, you know, the education system and what we pass down to our children, next generations. Of course, it's voting down the ballot in every election. And those kinds of things will be determinative. You know, we really need to be unified in a moment like this. We need to be on the same team in a moment like this. And, you know, hence the call for the Grand Summit, you know, to make sure that we truly do come together onto the same page, but also the accountability thereafter, making sure both internally in our own families, but also as a community, as a district, as a state, and as a nation, making sure that we hold each other accountable, hold our leaders accountable, you know, because there's really no time to wait. The time really is right now. So to continue this conversation, I would encourage you to bring this to your own families and to your own communities. Continue to post about this and highlight it on Black media and your own social medias within, you know, your networks. That way this idea spreads across the nation, because that's what is really needed right now to kickstart this idea that I had, and big picture to kickstart the turning point that we need for this country. You know, that really is the urgency of now. Like Jonathan said, it is now. A year ago, 10 years ago, it's now.
A shout out to the Doc Sanchez, FM F. I'm not sure what that means, but thank you so much for your comments and for being a listener. We've seen you here before. And again, Big Cheese, thank you as well. You know, even if we disagree, it's important that we have the conversation. Melvin Whitfield Carter Jr., my friend, thank you so much for your voice, your work, and your commitment. I would expand this conversation for the next time. Let's do this again, Haley,
Right, because please.
I think that for me, this is Al McFarland, and I know that I'll get pushback from the Big Cheese on this. I'm not as committed to the idea of that we can achieve our freedom by looking at what we call